Glad to have you all with us for Political Rewind. If you're listening in real time, it's Monday, and everybody's so happy about a new work week starting, although it is 4th of July week, so Jim Galloway, a short work week for everybody. Are you going to be going to watch fireworks somewhere, Jim?
No, we're going to be, I think we're going to be more locked down with a dog that doesn't like fireworks.
Yeah, I understand that. That's Jim Galloway. He, of course, is the lead political writer for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. You read him in the Wednesday and Sunday paper, and he oversees the Political Insider blog at AJC.com. Julianne Thompson, who is a Republican strategist, has been involved in state Republican politics for a long, long time. You are also, is there a formal organization, Trump Women, Women for Trump in Georgia, that you're
Women
overseeing?
Yes, Women for Trump is an actual organization.
Okay.
and a political action committee called Women Vote Smart.
Okay. We're glad to have you back, Julianne.
Thank you. Thanks
later,
for having me.
I hope we'll have time. You made a trip. You were did a trip to Israel.
Yes.
With AIPAC. If we get a chance later in the show, we should ask you, just for your impressions. I don't want to get into a big political discussion.
Yeah, sure. It was technically with their educational arm called AIEF.
Uh-huh.
But yes, it was AIPAC sponsored through AIEF, and it was a fantastic trip. And I'd love to talk about my takeaways.
There's nothing like going into Jerusalem and suddenly realizing you are surrounded, in some cases, by buildings that are more than 3,000 years old.
It's the only place in the world that you can go and open up a Bible and point exactly to where that particular scripture happened.
Well, welcome home.
Thank you.
And Wendy Davis joins us for the first time, down from Rome. Wendy, it's a real pleasure to have you here. You are in your second term, I think I'm right, as a Rome City Commissioner.
Right.
You also are a member of the Democratic National Committee from Georgia.
Correct.
And you do political consulting work. You've done it for a long time. Jim Galloway, I think, remembers a campaign you worked on way back when.
Wendy and I go way back. far further back than either of us want to know.
Don't do the math.
And you also do consulting, but you have an interesting tool that you use for your consulting work.
Thank you. Yes, I produce telephone town hall events, which I think are one of the best voter contact tools. You put your candidate or your leader of your organization right in folks' bedrooms or living rooms or kitchens, wherever they're answering the phone, and have a really great interactive conversation. So it's kind of like creating your own radio show over the telephone is the analogy we often use.
Okay. Wendy, a member of the Democratic National Committee, we should point out that your husband, Julianne, is a national committeeman for the Republican National Committee.
Yes, he is.
All right, good. So let's get started on the show. Jim, before we get into a number of the issues that we're going to talk about in more depth, let's just briefly say that there's a breaking news story, broke about 2 hours ago. Jenna Garland, who was Kasim Reed's press secretary, was in court today because she was indicted for a violation of the Open Records Act. She apparently was offered a plea deal by the attorney general's office, which her lawyer said she wasn't going to take because they didn't have enough time to process all the evidence. But why is this case of particular interest?
Well, number one, it's the first time anyone has ever been prosecuted under this. That's probably another reason why she didn't plead out. There's no precedent. There's no precedent to follow. You're pushing the frontier and you're creating laws as you go. So, and plus this is only a misdemeanor. No jail time is involved. There could be some fines if she's found guilty.
One of the reasons it's also interesting, Jim, is it's kind of at the intersection that we're paying a lot of attention to these days, which is when journalists ask for records. Under state law, they have the right to collect many, many records. And Jenna Garland, in this case, the Attorney General's office would say that they have emails in which she tells her people, don't even pay attention, ignore them, we're not answering.
Slow walk them as much as possible, yes.
So what I started here is the intersection between politics these days and journalism, and we're seeing more and more questions about how journalists are given access, how they're treated by government officials. So there are a lot of reasons why it's a case of some interest, even though they're just misdemeanor offenses.
Right, and it's access to documents isn't just something that has been kind of a football with Democratic players. Republicans play it all the time, especially in state government.
Wendy, you look like you're about to say something about this.
Well, I just think it's fascinating how different people have a different approach to open government, right? And I don't think it's necessarily a partisan situation, but it's a situation that, as a city official, I am very cognizant of. And I am somebody who, probably because of my political background, has been more engaging of the media rather than, you know, it'd be okay if y'all come, you know, welcoming the media, trying to make sure that the city is doing a good job telling our story and recognizing that the media isn't the enemy. They can help us tell our story, and that sort of openness is good for our city, good for our state, good for America, in my personal opinion.
Well, I think it's really interesting that you just said that is not necessarily a partisan viewpoint. And that's exactly right, Julianne. We have Democrats who are reluctant to talk to the media. And now, again, we're talking about the difference between an open records request, which is something in Georgia statute that is, in fact, that enables journalists to request things, and more voluntary efforts at communicating with journalists. There are Republicans who don't want to talk to the media. There are Democrats who don't want to talk to the media. My experience has been that what Wendy's saying happens to be correct, that the political leaders who are willing to talk to us, to tell us what we want to know, almost always, whether they're Democrats or Republicans, get pretty fair treatment. And in some cases, better treatment than the people who don't want to have anything to do with us.
And that's always been my experience. I'm the former press secretary of the Georgia Republican Party, so I worked with the media on a regular basis. And I personally never received any sort of unfair treatment from them as long as I dealt with them. And if I ignored them, of course, they always felt like they had more to uncover. So,
yeah, my funny experience, she made me think about it. I was deputy press secretary for the Secretary of State's office way back in the day. And people, then again, I came from the campaign world, so people tended to be a little freaked out that I worked beyond 5 p.m., right, and was responsive, even if it was 5:30 or 6. Because, again, you, in my mind, you want to help the media tell the right story. So,
all right, well, we're going to watch how this unfolds with the case that Chris Carr has brought. Jim, it's July 1st, which means that a number of new Georgia laws go into effect as of today. One of them that'll be interesting, most interesting to watch, I think it's fair to say, is the new law which creates a structure by which 6 private companies can now grow medical marijuana in Georgia. And of course, the problem for a couple of years since the first medical marijuana bill was passed has been, yes, there are licenses for families who who qualify for medical marijuana, but no way to bring it in the state legally. Now we start the structure.
Right, right. Now you start to decide who can grow it and under what circumstances, and it is a very, very burdensome structure that's contained in the laws. I mean, this has to be, it has to be grown entirely indoors, within a camera shot. Every moment of every plant's life, every plant has to be accounted for. And what's going to be most interesting, I think, is to see who gets those 6 licenses.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a hard time because I'm not sure, Julianne, I should have researched this. I don't know how many licenses the state has now given out to people who qualify with conditions the state has said will allow you to purchase cannabis oil. But I don't think it's such a huge number that at least immediately you're going to be making a fortune, are you, off this growing the product?
I really don't know how long that's going to take.
Yeah.
And I don't know how licenses are going to be given out to dispense as well. So I think that that's yet to be seen. But I'm like Jim, I'm very interested to see who gets those licenses. And, you know, who are some of the powers that be that are going to profit off of some of those licenses? And I think that that has been some of the controversy that we've heard from a lot of activists, I think, on both sides of the aisle.
I think if you're a state official, you're allowed to own, what, maybe 15% of a, it's they thought of that. They thought of how much money that a state official can be allowed to own in that kind of an enterprise.
So two additional notes as we watch to see who gets these licenses. Number one, there's still no distribution system set up in the state, Wendy. So, you know, if I were one of the six licensees, I may be able to grow the product, but there's no pipeline to deliver it until the state decides to come up with a system for licensing the distributors.
Right. I think there's a lot that's cumbersome and confusing, right, about it. And there are a lot of families who are really struggling. I have a friend of mine, his son has seizures, and he's just crying for these options and these opportunities. And you all know agriculture is such a huge part of our economy. And as state after state has legalization, I happen to be of the opinion our farmers need to be able to be a part of that process. So let's figure out how to help folks locally, or how to let our farmers be able to, you know, have a legal crop that is legal and for people to have those opportunities, especially in terms of medical marijuana. It's so important.
And I never understood the controversy when it comes to treating intractable seizure disorder or to treating cancer or glaucoma, because a lot of the people that are so fundamentally against using medical marijuana as a treatment, and that being said, I do not support recreational use of marijuana or the legalization thereof. However, as a person whose sister passed away from cancer, or who actually passed away from chemotherapy as a result of having cancer, I've seen a lot of drugs out there that are absolutely far worse and have far worse side effects than medical marijuana ever would. And I don't see any of those people who are so fundamentally against medical marijuana doing any sort of protesting against some of those other drugs.
The other interesting thing about this, Jim, is that pharmacies are now legally able, at least by Georgia law, to distribute marijuana oil. The problem becomes that federal law still prohibits it. So if you're Walgreens, CVS, whatever, you're not likely to want to jump in and risk some kind of federal prosecution.
If you're an independent pharmacist, you might. You might, although you have to be careful how you advertise it, because there are even restrictions on how you cannot use the color green when you advertise it.
Oh, you cannot.
I didn't know that.
You got to read the legislation. It's really, really detailed.
All right. Wow. So, Wendy, there are people, and I'm curious, you as a city member of the city commission in Rome, there are people who believe this is a slippery slope. Julianne already made it very clear in the way she answered that question. She did not want to see recreational marijuana legalized in Georgia. But, of course, the opponents for a long time to even medical marijuana have said that's what they fear most. As a city commission member, do you... I don't know whether you support recreational marijuana or not, but do you think it's more likely that it's suddenly going to pop up in Rome, Georgia, down the road because the legislature has taken that slide down the slope?
I see a very big difference between medical marijuana and recreational marijuana, right? And I think Georgia is a long way from legalizing recreational marijuana. I think a lot of cities have taken the steps to decriminalize it. Right. The question is, do we spend our resources of our police officials and the jail officials putting people in jail for, you know, having a very small amount of marijuana, or do we write them a ticket?
Are you like looking at that in not just you specifically? Is the Rome Commission looking at that?
I have absolutely no thoughts that my colleagues have an interest in that, but a lot of cities are doing it. But we, but again, it's about resources, and we do often talk about, you know, where we want our police officers spending their time and energy. So and methamphetamine and opioids are a far bigger problem than marijuana is in all of our communities.
So to close out this portion of the conversation, I will suggest that and maybe we can find it online. The New York Times this weekend ran a piece about how Colorado has changed in 5 years since recreational marijuana was legal there. And in some cases, they think things are fine and moving well. And in many others, there are great concerns about what the proliferation of recreational marijuana in the state has been. If we can find that article and post it on our social media platforms, that'd be great. Jim Galloway, another issue that was passed by the legislature and goes into effect today is evidence in sexual assaults. It's been, I think the law had mandated keeping DNA samples, that kind of evidence, for 10 years after a crime. The new law says 50 years.
50 years. Yeah, yeah. I mean, and look, think of these serial killer instances. I think there was one out in California not too long ago where they came after a 70-year-old man because they had come across the DNA evidence and retested it and found and went through ancestry.com to find his cousins and such. But it's look, this is kind of an interesting Democratic Republican partnership that is especially between David Ralston, the House Speaker, and Scott Holcomb, the state rep. You'll remember that a couple years ago that Renee Unterman tried to step in front of the first attempt to get rape kits tested. She got bulldozed. She is partnered with Scott Holcomb on that issue this year, and it is not a coincidence that she's also running for Congress. So that's helpful.
Jim is absolutely correct. It was back in 2016 that Scott Holcomb, who I think is on the show later this week, next week, Scott will be back on the show next week. excuse me. There was at the time a terrible backlog in processing of rape kits in many jurisdictions around the state. And Holcomb did partner with Ralston, and they were able to pass a statute back then which expedited the processing of rape kits. And I think they were able to process like 3,000 in a fairly short amount of time. So this is the next step, keeping that evidence for future crimes. This is pretty important.
I think it's very important because, remember, DNA evidence has the ability to convict, but it also has the ability to exonerate. So I think it's in a very, very important step in the right direction. And I think it's incredible that we've actually found something that both sides of the aisle can agree on and work together on. And I think that Georgia citizens are very happy about that.
Yeah, it's so kudos again. Scott Holcomb was the one who took the lead in making this an issue that rose to the top of people's radar screens. And it's horrifying, and I'm sure, Julian, you feel this way, too, to think of all these, again, we talked about 3,000 in Georgia that were backlogged. We have such a problem with people being, survivors of assault and the question of will they be believed and, you know, what's going to, it's so much a part of this Me Too movement. But the criminal justice aspect of it, for too long, women and men too can be victims, but predominantly you think about the women who have been, you know, having a rape kit put on them is not a comfortable situation, although that evidence being collected, and to think that evidence wasn't being processed was another reason that women wouldn't come forward, because they thought that nothing would happen and no one would be caught, and it's just something they needed to just handle on their own.
All right. So those are just a couple. There are a few more statutes that went in effect. You can read about them on Political Insider blog at AJC.com if you want to see a few more that went into effect on July 1st. By the way, Robert Jimison just sent me a note. He's posted it. That New York Times piece on Colorado 5 years after recreational marijuana was legalized is now there for you to read on Twitter. And I think on our Facebook Live post as well, which, by the way, if you aren't watching us on Facebook Live, go to the GPB news page. You'll see us all sitting here in our temporary studio.
Most of us are wearing black, so we kind of blend in with the scenery. We're just talking heads.
Wendy Davis, you recently were on you moderated a panel for the Georgia Municipal Association?
Yes.
I don't remember the precise title, maybe you do, but it was essentially helping municipalities understand how to make the census figures, the data that each city gets, pay off in bigger ways. What was that about?
Well, it was really about making sure that cities are attuned to getting ready for the census next year, right? So if I could take a step back, a lot of folks don't understand the census is going to be conducted in a different way than it's ever been conducted before. They're not going to send a form to your house. They're going to send an invitation for you to go online or to make a phone call to participate in the census. So there's a lot of concern that communities that have typically been hard to reach are now going to be harder to reach because it's not just, you know, form came to you, fill it out, send it back in. It's you have to take these extra steps. I was trying to convince cities that they need to be very proactive because of all the financial ramifications of undercounting, that we need to be starting now finding ways because the flip side, the good part of the new way to do it is we can take our smartphones or we can take a regular phone, you know, any kind of phone. We can take a laptop, a tablet to places where people are gathered and we can help. You know, I want to be in churches and where they come pay their water bill and in the library. And I'm going to take it to Rome Braves games, right? Make sure go down the row. Everybody, have you done your census yet? So, but the money is really significant. Can I hit that part?
Sure.
So the GMA took a figure of what
that
the
local... That, again, is Georgia Municipal Association.
Yeah, they took a figure of the federal dollars that come down to cities and came up with a figure of for every individual who is not counted, that's $2,300 of funding that doesn't come to your community. So think about the math there for a second. I've got my little cheat sheet here. So that's for 1 year. For 10 years, of course, that's $23,000. So if you miss 44 people, right, you undercount, don't count 44 people, college students, right, or people in a nursing home or the homeless people, 44 people undercounted is more than $1 million over 10 years that your city would lose. So you get to 218 people, and that's $5 million over the 10 years that you would lose. So we're trying to put... There's all kinds of controversy. There's skepticism at every angle of the political spectrum about the census. And my point was, we need to be prepared. We need to be helping. We need to get people together now so we're not undercounting the folks.
And of course, Julianne, what makes this really interesting, by the way, to add to your figure, Wendy, and then I'll ask my question, Julianne, in fiscal year 2015, which was a period when, although the census is every 10 years, monies are distributed throughout the 10-year period. In 2015, census data was used to determine the allocation of $675 billion dollars for 132 different federal programs. Okay, so having said that, you know my question. We've spent so much time talking about the question of whether the citizenship question, which the administration wants to put on the 2020 census, is strictly for partisan gain. Of course, we've seen the Thomas Hofeller study, in which he said that adding the citizenship question will, in fact, help Republicans win more seats, gerrymander more effectively. So we've had that conversation, and it'll still continue because the Supreme Court kicked that back down to the lower courts. But quite apart from that political question is the question of if you're a Republican county somewhere and you decide you want the citizenship question asked, you're looking at the loss of federal funds, perhaps. So it's not just a partisan political question. It's a fiscal question.
Well, that's true. It puts you in a very precarious situation. I'm interested as to how they think that this is going to be the way to go about doing it, to just send an invitation to do it online. I can't imagine that people are actually going to take the time to do it.
Which is why
I think there's going to be a huge drop-off.
Yes.
Not just the people that for years have been paranoid about the census, my mom and dad being one of them, would never let the census guy in, never wanted to answer the questions. But, I mean, this is not just going to be those people who probably don't even use email, but people that just don't want to take the time to bother.
Again, the political turmoil is at every part of the spectrum. And that's why, again, I was trying, people understand green. They could fight about, you know, citizenship, not citizenship, but about the resources coming and people being counted. And that's why it's so important. We're going to have trusted voices going to each individual. And somebody who might respond well to me might not be someone who responds well to you, right? And same thing with our neighbors who are Latinx and our African-American neighbors who are traditionally undercounted. The most surprising area that's undercounted that surprised me was 0 to 5-year-olds. folks aren't counting their babies.
Wow.
Yeah, and look, it's not just green. It is pure political power at the federal level. Georgia has had 9.7 million people counted in 2010. Right now, we're estimated to be up above 10.63 million. There's got to be at least one additional congressional seat in that increase. And if these people don't get counted, then maybe we don't get that congressional seat. Maybe one congressional, maybe two congressional seats go down to one. And that affects both Republicans and Democrats.
Well, yeah, that's exactly why I brought that up, Jim. The argument has been that we've been part of here on this show, and it's certainly been talked about across the country, is that if you ask a citizenship question, the Census Bureau itself says that 6.5 million fewer people, primarily Latinos, people of Hispanic descent, won't want to participate because they're afraid of the government. So it's interesting that if that is a Republican argument, that at the same time, an undercount doesn't help the communities that Republicans are in.
That's because, I mean, we've got a set number of members of Congress, 435. There are going to be, with population growth and population decline, there are winners and losers. For the last, I think since World War II, Georgia has been a winner. You hate to give up. Remember that with a congressional seat comes an additional electoral college vote as well.
Right. By the way, I believe, Julianne, and we'll fact check this, I believe that these online questionnaires are merely the first line that the Census Bureau is using. If your mom and dad, skeptics that they are of the Census Bureau, choose not to answer the form, a enumerator will come knocking on their door.
Right.
So there is a second line to people.
And now, actually, the really interesting thing, too, is they have twice that they'll try to come to your door, and then they're going to guess, right? They're going to take, they haven't done this before. They're going to take, like, if your tax records for your parents' house says your dad's name, right? They're going to say there's one person living at that house. So it won't be a zero as it would have been in the past, but it's not going to be a two, or if there are more people living in that household. And they're also are behind the ball in hiring people. So 2020census.gov/jobs, they're talking about needing to hire 200 people in Rome, Georgia alone. They're hiring thousands of people across the state, but it feels like you're applying into a black hole. Apply anyway. They're really well-paying jobs, especially for my part of the state.
Julianne, I would think out in your county, Gwinnett, it would be advantageous to have, given how diverse you are now, every single person in that county counted. And this notion that we should have a citizenship question probably would do some harm to Gwinnett County, don't you think?
I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know. That's something I need to give a lot more
thought. Am I pushing this too hard at you?
You kind of are.
Okay.
So one more thing to think about, right?
I apologize.
And this is a really local government kind of thing. The way we divide up the SPLOST dollars, right, in every community, the cities and the counties sit down and have very fierce negotiations in some communities, but it's all based on those census numbers. Right. So if your city loses population relative to your county, or your county loses population relative to your city, it's going to change the balance of how those dollars.
Is that written into law? I ask that because if you have a citizenship question, then you could possibly have those same dollars divvied up according to U.S. citizenship.
Mm-hmm. Oh, interesting point. Mm. All right, we got to get to a break. We're a little late for our first break in the show. When we come back, we have a lot more to talk about, and we'll do that in a moment.
Financial contributions from listeners like you are not the only gifts that keep GPB on the air. In fact, many listeners have already chosen to donate a used vehicle to GPB. We'll pick up your vehicle for free and send you the paperwork for your taxes. Get started today. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or go to gpb.org/cars. That's 877-GPB-1-CAR or gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
On the next Fresh Air, the human toll of moderating Facebook's content. We talk with journalist Casey Newton about the people who work for outside contractors monitoring texts or images of hate, murder, child exploitation, animal abuse, and more. Many workers are traumatized. One contractor died. Newton also will tell us what Facebook is doing about it. Join us.
Fresh Air this afternoon at 3 right here on GPB and online at gpbnews.org.
Welcome back. Before we move on to our next topic on the show, you know, every now and then, doesn't happen often, but every now and then we try to do a fact check based on something that's been said on Political Rewind that we're wondering about. I want to fact check myself if I can, and I'll admit this is somewhat gray area that I'll bet, Julianne, you'll have a reaction to. On Friday's show, when we talked about the debate, the Thursday night debate, we talked about the fact, Jim, that every candidate, all 10 candidates, raised their hand in answer to a question, would you give up private, should we give up private insurance for Medicare for all? I said that Kamala Harris was the first one to try to walk that back the next morning by saying she understood the question to be something different and that she seemed to be backtracking. Well, I went back and I looked at the transcript of the Thursday night debate, and I have to say I think the way Lester Holt framed the question is open for interpretation. Here's what he said. He said, many people watching at home have health insurance through their employer. Who here would abolish their private health insurance in favor of a government-run plan? Kamala Harris did say, Jim, that she thought she was asked if she would do that. It's a little squishy, but I did feel that I needed to correct what I had said on Friday's show.
Yeah, it might have been better phrased. I think more problematic for the Democratic candidates on that Thursday night was everyone raised their hand on should health care be extended to illegal immigrants.
I want to get into that in a few minutes because I think it's an important conversation. If we can just move on to a couple other things, and then we'll come back to presidential politics. Jim, I guess it was Greg Bluestein who filed a story that David Ralston over the weekend had a meeting of his caucus in which he, according to Bluestein, essentially did two things. Number one, he tried to put behind him. He wants everybody to get together and stop whatever pushback they're giving him over this question of whether he's using his job as speaker to take advantage of that position in the interests of his private legal clients, his law clients, but also to say, look, right now we need to be united because we're getting challenged by Democrats out there. The legislature is on the verge of turning over if we're not careful. And so he urged unity, and then he suggested something interesting. He said, maybe it looks like the vice president may be coming in to help legislators, Republican incumbents, hold on to their seats.
And there's a specific reason for that. Okay, if you're David Ralston, well, first of all, that Supreme Court decision in which you had five justices say that the courts should stay out of politically based gerrymandering, that has put a huge target on the speaker, because basically what it has told Democrats is that it's open season, that they can expect no mercy in the 2020 census, in the aftermath of the 2020 census. So if they do not control either the governorship, the House, or the Senate, then things could look very bleak for them over the next 10 years. So you're going to see a huge amount of money being poured into state house races because that's the place where Democrats and Senate and Democrats and Republicans are closest. There are 22 seats, house districts where Stacey Abrams won more than 40%. There are 15, and remember, that's the margin, 15 seats where she won 45%. And those are the targets. And if you have, in these November contests, if you have Republicans pressed on whether they supported Ralston and his conduct in his law firm, then, the members of the House Republican Caucus are worried about that.
Julianne, I would think that's a particular, again, I bring up the fact that you're a Gwinnett County resident. Mm-hmm. Gwinnett County is going to be one of the real ground zeros for that fight.
Yes, it most certainly is. And to follow up on what Jim said, I mean, the bottom line is our elected leadership, they have two bosses. They have the constituents that elected them, and they have the caucus leaders that put them into leadership, or the caucuses that put them into leadership positions. And with regard to David Ralston and his leadership, this is a decision for them to make. There's the court of public opinion. There are the, you know, the local Republican parties that have passed some measures, but then the state Republican Party is staying out of making, coming to any sort of opinion where that's concerned, which I think, given the situation, is probably the wise thing to do, because, like I said, there's a court of public opinion and then there's reality. And reality is that this is ultimately up to the leadership. And
you mean the Ralston, how yes. he fares in yes. terms of being, if the Republicans control the House next year, whether he continues as Speaker?
This is up to the elected leadership, yes.
Yeah, but what about the larger question of how much is at stake here? You know, we always, we've made this point on the show before. Right now, it is Republicans here in Georgia and in a number of states who have used gerrymandering brilliantly to the Republican Party's advantage. Of course, the Supreme Court case was a Democratic case out of Maryland and a Republican case in North Carolina. But we've also made the point that when Roy Barnes was governor, his people brilliantly used gerrymandering to make sure Democrats controlled it.
I'm not sure brilliant is the right word there.
No? Okay, Wendy, why are you shaking your head like Jim? I mean, they were criticized for it, but they accomplished what they wanted to.
In some ways, right? There are a lot of people, and I happened to be working down there watching it then, right?
Yeah.
When I was in the Secretary of State's office, it was one of my jobs to watch what they were doing. And, I mean, there are a lot of people who say that some of the deals that were made were not necessarily in the long-term interest of the party, right? But certainly in the short-term interest of incumbents. And that's always the fascinating thing, right? Like, redistricting is one of the things that, you know, has that smaller pool, as Julianne was talking about, right? Those elected leaders, you know, sometimes they'll draw a street out to get rid of somebody they're not a fan of, right? I mean, and that is that really about the long-term interest of the party, or is that about the individuals who are currently serving?
Point well taken. Democrats created a map that gave them firmer control, but it didn't serve Roy Barnes well, because it clearly was one of the issues that was held against him when he lost his bid for real. It wasn't just the flag, and it wasn't just teachers.
It was all things.
The animosity about how they had strong-armed the districts through gerrymandering.
Yeah, and the question now is do Republicans take that as a lesson or an example to be followed?
Well, it strikes me that so far what we haven't seen that yet, because we're now looking at, what, the second census since Republicans have taken control. Certainly in 2010, Republicans used it to their advantage.
Well, gerrymandering is not something that is exclusive to either political party.
Right, that was my point.
I mean, both sides use it.
Thank you. You said it much simpler than I did.
But, I mean, obviously there's a lot at stake with the election, and I am encouraged that leadership is taking it very seriously, and that if the vice president is willing to come into the state of Georgia and help us on that matter, I think that that's a fantastic thing.
Wendy, give us a quick snapshot of the lay of the land in terms of partisanship in Rome right now.
Well, all of our legislators are Republicans.
Mm-hmm.
All of our county commissioners are Republicans. The city commission, there are three of us who I identify as Democrats of the nine. And
those are nonpartisan offices.
They're nonpartisan
right.
offices, but
right.
I mean, again, and there's no D next to my name, but it's not a secret that I'm a Democrat.
Yeah, there's no secret about you being a Democrat.
Right, right,
What's the racial makeup of Rome?
We're a high 20s in African American. The Hispanic population is severely undercounted, and in my opinion, and very hidden in our community. So it's, you know, low single digits. Still, the community is still in many ways controlled by that, you know, classic affluent older Caucasian
but
folks.
Your mayor.
Our mayor is now an African American. First
yeah.
one. It's a shame that it took us till 2019 to break down that barrier. When we do an unusual thing, the nine of us pick the mayor every January. So first thing I did when I got elected, when I was sworn in 2014, first vote I made is for Bill Collins to have been mayor. It took me several years working with folks to make that happen. And again, didn't do it because he's a Democrat, but because he had been in 20 years and deserved that opportunity to leave.
Is Rome the only city that elects its mayor that way?
No, there are others that select their mayor that way.
But it's not.
Again, we have a city manager form of government, which I'm a big fan of, but I think we could elect our mayor and still have a city manager.
I mean, is he in essence just a chairman of a county commission?
He is. City commission.
On a smaller basis, yeah.
All right, let's thanks. I wanted to get that little snapshot. We have you here. We should ask you about that.
Thank you.
Let's move on. Jimmy Carter, for the first time, really aggressively spoke out critically of President Trump. It was at his big annual event in which he brings together hundreds of people, supporters, some of whom have been coming to these annual retreats with him for 25, 30 years. And in a conversation, I think it was John Meacham who was leading this particular conversation. Walter Mondale was sitting next to him. President Carter made this remark about President Trump.
Well, the president himself should condemn it, admit that it happened, which I think 16 of intelligence agencies have already agreed to say. And there's no doubt that the Russians did interfere in the election. And I think the interference, although not yet quantified, if fully investigated, would show that Trump didn't actually win the election in 2016. He lost the election, and he was put into office because the Russians interfered on his behalf.
So do you believe President Trump is an illegitimate president?
Based on what I just said, which I can't retract.
President Trump, not being a man, Jim Galloway, to take these things lying down, while he was in Japan at the G20, responded to President Carter. Let's listen to that and then talk about it.
Jimmy Carter, look, he was a nice man. He was a terrible president. He's a Democrat, and it's a typical talking point. He's loyal to the Democrats, and I guess you should be. Jimmy Carter, I was surprised that he would make a statement. I saw it. It was not a big thing, but I saw the statement. And it's, you know, a lot of Democrats like to make that statement. He's been trashed within his own party. He's been badly trashed. I felt badly for him because you look over the years, his party has virtually, he's like the forgotten president. And I understand why they say that. He was not a good president. Look at what happened with Iran. That was a disaster. What Iran did to him, they tied him up in knots. The reason Ronald Reagan probably became president.
Jim, he also, President Carter, went on to say that he thought that the president's border policies were deplorable. He said basically that our country now stands for torture and the kidnapping of little children. Those are really harsh words for Jimmy Carter, of all people.
Yeah, but you'll recall that a couple years ago, he also said that the U.S. was a barely functioning democracy because money had taken such a huge hole on our politics. But on Donald Trump, you should just to recall, we forget things that happened 48 hours, 2 weeks ago. And when Donald Trump decided he wanted to de-escalate a confrontation with Iran, Jimmy Carter in Sunday school said that he did the right thing. He praised him. And at that time, Donald Trump thought that Jimmy Carter was one of the best presidents the U.S. ever had.
Julianne, you must have cringed before Trump responded. I can only imagine how you felt about hearing Carter talk about a president that you were working to reelect.
Well, of course, I disagree with former President Carter, but I'm not going to take this opportunity to disparage him. I have a lot of respect for the service that he showed the country, although I disagree with him politically and I adamantly disagree with the comments that he made. But I am glad he is in good health, and he is certainly going to make his opinion known, and I'm glad that he is able to do that at his age.
Wendy, how do you look at this exchange?
So, again, I think President Carter has earned the opportunity to speak his mind. That's one thing I admire about people as they get older. They are less constrained, and they can just be candid, right, and say what they think. I think what troubles me the most about all of this is that the whole issue of Russian interference, which, again, as he said, our intelligence agencies had agreed that there was interference, the president has not admitted it happened. And more concerning to me right now is I don't think we're taking enough steps as a nation, as a state, to protect ourselves from similar interference for this upcoming election.
Okay, but Carter went past that. He didn't just say there was obviously Russian interference in the election. The intelligence agencies have all said that. He went a step further, Julianne. He said that essentially President Trump is an illegitimate president because it was Russian interference that elected him. The Mueller report does not say that. I don't know what the CIA has that may speak to that. But that's what I meant when I said I thought Carter went really far out on this one.
Well, I agree with you. And I completely, like I said, I disagree with former President Carter. Donald Trump is the duly elected president of the United States. And there was obviously Russian interference, but they interfered on both sides of the aisle. And as far as his comments calling
him... Well, I don't know about. Where are they interfering in the Democratic side?
Well, they had bots trying to attack Republicans against Democrats and Democrats against Republicans. They would have been they were involved in the election to try to take down our country.
Okay.
It's not just electing one person over the
other. Jim, get the final word.
Yeah,
we've got to get to a break.
The Mueller report says that, yes, they interfered, and they interfered on Trump's side. They didn't say, to your point, they didn't say whether it was an effective interference
right.
of any sort. But I should say that this also occurred while Trump was in Japan. He had, right beside Vladimir Putin, he was asked if he had warned Putin off any further interference. And it became something of a joke.
I just think, thank you for that. We got to get to a break. I just think it was interesting to hear Jimmy Carter speak so aggressively in this particular instance about the sitting president of the United States, who, of course, responded as quickly as he could. Let's get our final break of the show out of the way, and we'll come back and have a bit more on Political Rewind.
Now is the perfect time to clean out the garage and get rid of that car you no longer need. You'll face the coming months with a fresh start, and by donating your used car to GPB, you'll even get a tax deduction. Call 877-GPB-1-CAR or donate securely online at gpb.org/cars. And thanks.
I'm gonna get in my car. Ooh, drive away. Ooh, drive so far.
Tech companies need a lot of energy to power their data centers around the world.
The amount of data that you need in order to fuel your YouTube or to run all of those Google searches, it's an enormous amount of energy, and it's something that many of the companies have struggled with.
We'll hear about Google's plan to use clean energy 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Join us for All Things Considered this afternoon from 4 to 7 here on GPB.
Jim Galloway, we've now seen the needles moving in two different directions as a result of the Democratic presidential debates last week. Most noticeably, Joe Biden, after the exchange, particularly with Kamala Harris, but I think more generally because many people thought his performance was not exactly as sharp as it should have been, dropped by about 4 or 5%, depending on the poll you look at. Bernie Sanders remained in most of the polling about the same place he was. Kamala Harris came up. She picked up the 5 or 6% that Biden lost in right. most of the polls.
And Elizabeth Warren is got to be kind of in that APAC, too, I think, at this point.
Have you picked your... I guess because you're on the DNC, you're not going to endorse.
Because I'm on the DNC, I'm a now superdelegate without right. a vote in the first round,
right.
Which I hope doesn't come to bite us back in the nose or some other body part if we have more than one round. I'm trying.
First round meaning the first vote at the convention, at the nominating
right.
convention.
So we are still, I would rather have us said that we can't endorse than say that we can't vote. I am working very hard to say positive things about all of our candidates. I think we have
about all 23
well,
of them.
Well, I don't have time to say positive things about all 23, but I am trying, and I'm trying to make sure we're not sowing discord among ourselves, right? I want people. You've got to find your person and you know knock yourself out trying to get them to be the nominee, and I love that, right? But we can do that without saying the other person's a blah 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 blah, right? We can let's talk about issues.
Did you watch the Thursday night debate?
Yeah. But again, they didn't talk about the size of their hands, right? They were talking about policy.
Okay.
Right? I mean, we can disagree, and I mean, families disagree,
yeah.
Right? And there are going to be differences, but I think you saw 20 people who all have a positive view of the future of this nation.
Okay. We're not going to talk about presidential politics for the next couple of minutes because you said you would love to take a couple of minutes. And by the way, we will be talking about presidential politics a lot in the weeks ahead. I just wanted to get that quick item in there about how the polling seems to be shaping up. So tell us briefly, you were in Israel as a guest of AIPAC, which is the biggest lobbying organization, pro-Israel lobbying organization, maybe in the world, certainly in the United States. So we're not going to get into the policies, the problems. What do you think?
Well, first of all, let me just be technical and say I was a guest of AIEF, their educational foundation,
okay.
Their educational arm of AIPAC. But I learned so much. I mean, it wasn't just about the history of Israel, which is rich, and it's not just about the fact that you can walk down the street and like I said earlier, point to where a scriptural story takes place and see it right before your eyes. We did get into the political complexities, which I won't detail here, but I will say that I did have the opportunity to visit the Israel-Lebanon border and the border between Syria and Israel. I had the opportunity to be in the home of a woman who is an Israeli citizen who lives on the border of the Gaza Strip. We saw rocket shells that had been dropped on her moshav while we were there. She explained to us what it's like to live in Israel and what it's like to deal with that situation on a daily basis. Yet they prosper. Yet they're leading the world when it comes to issues of desalinization. And they actually have the only... that's the only place in the world that the desert is actually receding. They have made the desert bloom.
Jim Galloway, you were posted there for a while.
Yeah, post 9/11. It's been about 8 weeks there.
What's interesting, and we're really running out of time, but what's fascinating about going to Israel, I think, whether you're in Tel Aviv or Jerusalem or any of the other parts of the country, is how you can be there having a full experience and not ever being aware of the kind of tensions and problems that and the threats that could be going either way.
Yeah, and you know, after spending a lifetime outside Israel, you go there and you realize this is an incredibly yeah. small place
yeah.
with an overabundance of history.
You've been there?
I haven't. I'd love to come on another time and talk about my recent trip. I went to Taiwan and learned about their government and their 40-year-old democracy. So that'd be fun to talk about sometime.
Summer vacation. Everybody goes off. We're out of time. Wendy Davis, Julianne Thompson, Jim Galloway, thank you so much for being here for Political Rewind today. Thank all of you for listening to us today. By the way, we are coming up on a very important milestone, and you'll hear more about it later. In about a week or so, Political Rewind will be 5 years old, moving into our sixth year on the air, and it's all thanks to all of you out there who listen to us and tell us you want more Political Rewind. I'm Bill Nygut. We'll see you again for another Political Rewind. In the meantime, have a great afternoon.